Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Is the water you drink from the faucet at home safe? Is it free from lead or other contaminants? Has it been treated? Where's it coming from? Who inspects your water source? How often? Penn Live completed a multi-month investigation into Pennsylvania's water. Tapped Out: How Pennsylvania's Failing Water System is Hurting You should make us all think about something many of us take for granted. Joining us today is the reporter who has written and reported this story, Penn Live State House and investigative reporter Wallace McKelvey. Wallace, welcome to the program.
A pleasure, as always.
If you have a question or comment, there's a lot to think about with this story. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@wytf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WYTF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWYTF. Again, that number, 1-800-729-7532. Just a personal note, Wallace, congratulations on this. This is why journalism matters, a good piece of journalism with this series. And it should make a lot of people think. In fact, I said to you this morning that I've talked to a couple people who have read your stories and said, I don't know if I want to know about this. And you told me that a lot of people have that reaction.
As with a lot of things, if you don't think about it, then it's not a problem. And part of the reason why this is such a tough story, and I think of this, writing this story, it's as much an explainer as it is an investigation, because there are a lot of complex ideas, concepts, very technical stuff that you have to wrap your head around. Although at its core, it's very simple. We have 8,500 drinking water systems in the state, and we can get into what that means. But for that number, right now we have 41 fully trained drinking water inspectors.
And I want to talk about that. That is just one of the issues that you explore. But I want to quote the very first sentence in your very first story. A cascade of failures mean that Pennsylvanians can no longer take clean water, a right so important it's enshrined in the state constitution, for granted. Why not?
So there are several threads here. First thread is this. So if you are on a private drinking well, you're basically responsible for your own water. You have to do your testing all by yourself and make sure that what's coming out of your private well is good quality water. However, most of us are not on private wells. Most of us are on public drinking water systems. So the best way to think about this is if you are under PA American Water, for example, a private company. If you are on a municipal system such as Steelton Borough Authority, or if you ever have visited a rural Sheets or Wawa, or if you've ever gone to a campground, if your kids go to school on a water system, all of those are public water systems. And anytime you interact with one of those systems, you're kind of leaning on the trust that that system is properly treating the water, that the infrastructure is being maintained, that there's not, for example, lead leaching out of the pipes and coming into your water and entering your body. And you're also trusting on this, you're trusting this larger system that is governed by the Department of Environmental Protection. Now, these drinking water inspectors, what they do is they're in some sense the last line of defense. So the first line is the systems themselves. They're required to do X, Y, and Z to make sure that clean water is getting to you and that the actual infrastructure is there to convey that water safely to you. On the DEP side, what they're doing is they...
Department of Environmental Protection, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
It's a state agency.
Right. And they've been authorized by the federal government, by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, to carry out the Safe Drinking Water Act. Basically, they're required every 3 to 5 years, depending on specifically the type of system, they're required to go in and do a complete inspection where they go soup to nuts. They make sure that the actual treatment is getting done properly. They make sure that the equipment is functioning properly, that the people are doing what they're supposed to be doing in these water systems. And if they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, or if, for example, they find high levels of contaminants, lead and other carcinogens, byproducts from the treatment process, if they find any problems, they're supposed to follow up and make sure that these drinking water systems fix anything that these inspectors find. Well, there's a couple problems right now. The DEP has been short-staffed for the better part of a decade because of budget cuts that have been handed down in Harrisburg. And so we don't have nearly enough drinking water inspectors to ensure that this happens, that these inspections take place. And we also don't really have the staffing to enforce things. So some of these drinking water inspectors that I've talked to have said, I've written a bunch of notices of violation to say, hey, this water system has this problem, and this problem. But then they come back, you know, maybe in 3 years, maybe 5 years, maybe longer, because they're not getting around to some systems as often as they should. And they find the same problem. You know, for example, that if someone says, hey, this water system, it doesn't have a UV filter. And a UV filter is important because it helps kind of neutralize some of the biologics that will sicken you in the water. Your UV filter, either it isn't there or it's not functioning properly. You need to fix this immediately. Well, then they issue a notice of violation, and ideally the water system is supposed to correct that quickly. But a number of years down the line, they go back to the same system. They find the same problem. It hasn't been fixed.
Okay, so there are a number of issues you just brought up, but let's start with the inspections. Did you say 17 inspectors for the entire state?
No. 41.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Fully
I don't know
trained.
Where I got 17. But 41 fully trained inspectors for the entire state. How many water systems in the state?
8,500.
8,500. And they're supposed to get to those 8,500 at least once every 3 years?
Depending on the type of system, some of them every 3 years and some of them every 5 years, based on basically the number of people they serve and, you know, how regularly people are relying on them.
Okay. 17, the number I got 17 is that there was additional, I believe it's $3 million in this
yes,
year's budget that they can hire 17 additional.
The Wolf administration has committed to hiring 17 new inspectors to replenish the workforce this year.
Okay.
But that's also problematic, but we can get to that.
So 41 inspectors for the you know, more than 8,000 water systems across the state. All right. So first of all, do they have enough time to get to those systems every 3 to 5 years?
No.
Okay, that's what I figured.
December 2016, there was a letter that the EPA, in the very last days under the Obama administration, the EPA sent this letter to the DEP, and they basically said, Pennsylvania is risking public health because you are not properly staffing your drinking water inspection unit. And, you know, it is mathematically impossible in order to meet the minimum standards based on the number of inspectors you currently have.
Now, you talked for your series, you talked to inspectors. They didn't want to be named. In fact, you quote one guy saying, I like my job. I'm not a disgruntled employee. I'm concerned about what's going on here. What did they tell you?
I mean, they told me all sorts of things. But to give you a sense, like the example there with the UV filter, that came from one of the inspectors. But they all had similar stories. And I'm always kind of hesitant to grant anonymity to a source because you always have to understand their motivation, where they're coming from. Why are they coming to you? Why are they giving you this information? These drinking water inspectors and most, if not everyone at the DEP, it should be said, they have good intentions. They're not trying to pull the wool over anyone's eye. At least most of them aren't. They get into this a lot of them are very idealistic. They really enjoy their job. As one of them said, you know, I'm not a disgruntled employee. And they care very deeply about public health. They care very deeply about the various industries that they regulate. The problem is, you know, they see the degradation of this agency over time. You know, it started in the last budget that came down of the Rendell era. And then it continued under the Corbett administration. And then during the Wolf administration, we've seen kind of very small incremental increases in funding, but nothing to try to fix any of these problems in any concerted way. So these inspectors, when they came to me, they saw some of my early stories, and they said, "Hey, you're not getting at the full picture here. There's other stuff going on that you are not aware of, and the public needs to be made aware of this." You know, they're deeply concerned because drinking water is not, it's not something that's easily understood, but it is incredibly vital to our daily lives. You know, what did I ask for when I came into the studio? I asked for water. And, you know, we encounter water in basically everything we do every day. If that water is tainted, or even if there's doubt about whether that water is tainted, it undermines a lot of our society, a lot of our daily functioning. You think about it, you send your kids to school, what do they drink from? They drink from a water fountain. You know, and you're trusting that your children are not going to be poisoned.
You mention in the stories that schools are problematic for a unique reason.
Yeah, you know, and there are lots of these little details in here that drinking water inspectors have to be aware of. You know, and I don't want to raise unnecessary alarm bells, but to speak to that example, you know, schools, what's unique about them? Well, they generally shut down for periods of time. So, for example, over the summer, right now, most schools are either functioning very minimally, or no one's really there, you know, in using these pipes, using these fixtures. What can happen is if there's a lead problem or really any other kind of contaminant in the water, that water will sit in the pipes for long periods of time. And so, for example, if you have lead in the water and if you have lead in the pipes that water is sitting in, over time, that the level of lead in that water will increase. And also lead, also, you know, when you heat water, that also tends to concentrate lead as well. So that's another issue in the summertime. If you have stagnant water that is heating up, that will increase the amount of lead. So, you know, one example of this is, you know, if a school has a lead issue and the water sits in the pipes for 3 months, if you inspect that school at the end of summer or the very beginning of the school year, you're going to find elevated lead levels because of that. And also, you know, if children are drinking that water in the first week or so of school, they might very well be consuming high levels of lead because it's been sitting in the pipes for so long.
And just for background purposes, why is lead an issue in drinking water?
It causes a whole cadre of developmental health, mental health issues, especially in children. It's been shown to lead to even higher crime rates in people who consumed large amounts of lead in their childhood. It can also lead to severe kind of mental deficiencies later in life, lower IQ scores, for example. And we have we have systems in Pennsylvania that are dealing with high levels of lead currently.
Higher than Flint, Michigan, which gets all the attention.
Yeah, like Pittsburgh right now, in some sections of Pittsburgh, you have as high levels as we've seen in Flint and higher. And we also see elevated blood lead levels also in children in certain neighborhoods in Pittsburgh as well. Now, the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority, they push back on that. They say, well, there haven't been any studies that conclusively link the our elevated blood level, lead levels in children to our elevated lead levels in the actual water. But anywhere else you go, and it's been well-researched, well-documented, elevated lead levels in water lead to elevated blood lead levels in children.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about drinking water here in Pennsylvania with Penn Live State House and investigative reporter Wallace McKelvey. His series, Tapped Out, How Pennsylvania's Failing Water System is Hurting You, should be a must-read for many, many people across this state. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We're at at SmartTalk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You know, Wallace, there are a lot of issues that your stories raise, but one we hear about most often is infrastructure. And usually the words crumbling and failing precede infrastructure whenever it's being reported. Talk about water infrastructure in Pennsylvania. This is an old state. Some of these water systems are really old, but talk about the infrastructure we have.
And we might want to try to find another word other than infrastructure, although it's so easy to do, because I know even for me, when I hear the word infrastructure, my eyes start to glaze over a little bit. And I imagine if you're an ordinary citizen, you don't think about this very often. So let me be explicit. When we talk about water infrastructure, what we're talking about is the actual treatment plants that treat the water and make sure the water that reaches you is safe, that it doesn't contain any bacteria, that it doesn't contain any treatment byproducts that could give you cancer, and that it doesn't contain, you know, any of kind of a realm of contaminants. If you go to the story, it's water.pennlive.com. I go through a list of the most common contaminants, and some of them are quite fearsome. If you kind of click on a few of them and read about them, it will trouble you. So we're talking about the water treatment plants. We're also talking about the delivery system. Water, especially when we talk about lead, usually water leaving a treatment plant is fine in terms of lead. Where it tends to pick up lead is once it leaves a treatment plant and goes into the water mains, then into the smaller pipes, and then enters your home and then comes out your faucet. It's important to note that lead was not banned from most pipes until the mid-1980s. So there are water mains across the state in certain areas, and some areas have more of these than others, that all of the pipes, all of the sewer mains, or a large percentage of them contains some amount of lead. In Pittsburgh, for example, their distribution network, they haven't done a full inventory, and a full inventory would require a lot of work because we don't really know what's below our feet. We don't really have a firm idea of what's been installed over the years. But they estimate that roughly a quarter of the sewer mains and pipes in Pittsburgh contain lead. And then when you get to your home, that's a whole other beast, because you personally are responsible for the stuff that's in your home. Very easily, if your home is any kind of was built prior to the mid 80s, very likely that you have lead pipes, and you can usually check them by either, you know, trying to scratch them and see if they come up shiny. If they go from dull to shiny, there's a very good chance it's lead. Also, use a magnet, because lead will not draw a magnet to it. So that's a very easy thing for you to do in your own home, to find out if you have lead pipes, or if the service line entering your home, which is usually in the basement, if that is lead. So when we talk about infrastructure, we're talking about the treatment plant, we're talking about the delivery system, we're also talking about what's in your home. And the EPA, in their most recent estimate, they said, in order for things to be safe and fully compliant, in order for good drinking water to reach you, you know, Pennsylvania's water systems will have to invest something to the order of $16.8 billion.
Just Pennsylvania.
Just Pennsylvania over the next 20 years. And that does not really include lead. That if you were to try to replace all the lead pipes and service lines, that would be a significant amount of money that, as far as I've found, there's no firm estimate on it. You know, I saw one number, something close to $10 billion, but the simple fact is we don't know what we don't know.
All right, so let aside that $16.8 billion, what would that pay for to upgrade the infrastructure?
I mean, what you're talking about here is, for example, if you live in Pittsburgh, you've encountered this a lot, where the aging water and also sewer mains, but especially water, every winter, Pittsburgh has had to deal with a whole slew of water main breaks, because the actual pipes themselves are old, they're degrading, And then what happens when, you know, water, for example, freezes or pipes freeze, if you've ever had to deal with that in your house? Just imagine that on a much more massive scale with a lot more water coming through constantly. That's what Pittsburgh has had to deal with. And it also speaks to other issues. You know, Pittsburgh had, I don't want to beat up on them too much because Pittsburgh, they reflect a lot of the problems that can exist, but they're certainly not the only ones.
Well, and it's a much larger scale, too,
yeah,
because Pittsburgh's the second biggest city in the country. But you do focus on several different areas around the state. Locally, Harrisburg and Steelton. You know, something here that, and this is a line from one of your stories, too. The mains beneath Harrisburg are so corroded that stormwater and human waste in some parts of the capital city come into direct contact with the soil below. Now, I want to point out, we're talking stormwater there.
Not drinking water.
Not drinking water. But why is that an issue?
Well, that's an issue because everything is connected. Like, if you remember back to fifth grade science class, you probably learned about the water cycle. Well, part of the water cycle is this. Any water that you know, kind of flows off the ground will end up in groundwater, or it'll end up in the Susquehanna, in our case, in the rivers. Where does that water end up? Usually it gets pulled out for drinking water. That's one of the uses. So if you have contaminants directly entering the soil, at some point there's a very good chance that that water will reach an aquifer, and drinking water systems, they draw that water from the aquifer in order to serve their drinking water customers. Also, the Susquehanna River, Harrisburg has a long legacy of what's called sewer overflows. What happens is, you know, we have branches and other debris gets washed into the storm drains, and those same storm drains also accept whatever you flush down your toilet in Harrisburg. It's called a combined sewer system.
And it's not uncommon, right?
It's not uncommon at all. There are lots of them in Pennsylvania and nationwide. But it's problematic because you end up all the debris from the storm stuff, you know, in any kind of mid or large size storm, they run up against grates, or they run up against maybe a sewer main that's very old and starting to fail. And all that stuff ends up backing up. And in Harrisburg, they've had quite a few overflows where untreated water ends up in the Susquehanna River. Now, there are many water systems in Pennsylvania that pull water from the Susquehanna River, including Steelton, which is just downstream.
Well, let's talk about Steelton.
Steelton, you know, they argue that, you know, well, we pull our water from the Susquehanna in an area that's a bit removed from the sewer overflows in Harrisburg, which, yeah, I don't know. We'll not argue with that. But there are many other systems that pull water from the Susquehanna, so that's why overflows are problematic. Steelton is another kind of interesting case because they've run up against a number of violations with the Department of Environmental Protection. They're one of the systems where we know a lot about because they've had a lot of interactions. One of the problems there is they also, like many places, they have an aging infrastructure. Their treatment plant was built in the 1970s. And they have not, they're a high poverty community. It's not controversial to say that. And they're a municipal water authority. So they rely on their customers being able to pay them and being able to bolster the infrastructure needs of their water system. They also rely a great deal on the steel mill. And what has the steel mill been doing? They've been contracting over decades. They've been using less water. And every time they use less water, or every time the steel mill lays people off, well, Steelton doesn't have that money to reinvest into their water system. What you end up having is some serious treatment deficiencies in Steelton. And there was one case recently where a sensor had basically stopped working that was monitoring a very important contaminant, and it didn't record for a number of months. the DEP ended up finding out about this during an inspection, and they backtracked, and they realized that an employee there, who no longer works there, essentially falsified records in order to fill in that period of time when the sensor wasn't recording data. And there were also, in Steelton, elevated levels of treatment byproducts. So these are called trihalomethanes, and it's basically a class of contaminant that includes a number of different types of individual contaminants. The problem there is trihalomethanes are carcinogenic. Over time, they could very well lead to cancer. And if you have elevated levels of that is not good for you. Now, Steelton, again, my purpose is not to beat up on Steelton. There have been similar cases statewide. Trihalomethanes, it's something that all water systems have had to deal with. But the problem with maybe not having the right amount of oversight at the state level, so we know about Steelton, but what are all the other water systems out there like? When there aren't enough inspections, or when violations are issued but not followed up, what's happening that we don't know about? You know, what systems are out there that are allowing carcinogens to enter the water supply that haven't made the news, or maybe haven't even been noticed by the Department of Environmental Protection?
Our guest during this portion of the program is Wallace McKelvey. He's Penn Live State House and investigative reporter, talking about the water here in Pennsylvania series that Wallace worked on, Tapped Out, How Pennsylvania's Failing Water System is Hurting You. If you have a question or a comment, we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. As we're sitting here talking, as I read your series of stories, it got me thinking, why aren't people paying more attention to this? I mean, earlier in the program, I said that people kind of offhandedly said, I don't want to know. But this is something, as you pointed out, we deal with every single day. It is a big part of life anywhere. And it doesn't seem to be getting any attention from consumers, government, anyone who deals with it doesn't seem to get a lot of attention. Why?
And you think about it this way, you know, what was the most recent really huge issue of water contamination that made news that the average listener probably is aware of? It's Flint, Michigan. And when was the last time we heard about Flint, Michigan on the evening news? It's been a while. And guess what? I mean, their problems are not resolved there. They're still not. There are still people in Flint, Michigan who are relying on bottled water. It's going through a legal process. A bunch of people were charged criminally out there. But, Franklin Corey, who's he's a former lawmaker in Harrisburg, and he's actually the one who's responsible for the constitutional right to pure water that is written into our state constitution. I think this is an important point. If you are a Pennsylvanian, you are entitled to clean water. It is a right that is protected in the state constitution. And what that means is, you know, you could, if you believe your right is not being protected, you could go to the courts and you could sue. But Franklin Corey, I want to kind of read this to you. He said to me, I hate to say, but it'll take a disaster to fix this. And that's exactly what happened in Flint, Michigan. They had a disaster, and right now they're in the process of fixing it.
That's as a society, it seems as though that's what it takes all the time. I think about highways. I think about bridges, that usually it's a disaster that someone says, okay, a bridge has collapsed. Someone says, oh, we have to do something about the bridges. Now, to Pennsylvania's credit, in the last 4 years, we have made a lot even past that, it would start in the Corbett administration, that money has been dedicated for infrastructure as far as highways and transportation. But as you have pointed out, not here in the water area, that again, has an impact on people every single day. Let's take a phone call from Mark in Harrisburg. Mark, you're on the air.
Thank you. It sounds like you might have addressed one of my comments. I used to work for DEP, and I did do some water and quality enforcement. Major source of the problem is lack of funding. Lack of willing to assess people to pay the funding to do the infrastructure maintenance. But even when that's there, DEP lacks the will to take the enforcement action necessary to get it done.
Thank you very much for your call. He brings up something I did want to follow up on. You mentioned enforcement.
It's a very good point. And, you know, we as a state, our government, and even these water systems, they tend to be between a rock and a hard place. And you can kind of understand where they're coming from, although you always have to keep in mind that when they fail to do their job, they are risking public health. You know, I also profiled, I went out to some of the smaller public water systems, and I'll give you one example. This place called Beaver Brook, it's up in Luzerne County near Hazleton, and it is a former coal mining village where the people who live there, and there's about 200 people who live there, they are responsible for their network of pipes. They are responsible for testing their water. Basically, most of the duties that a private or municipal system would undertake, the residents of this tiny little community, they are responsible for it. And it largely falls to one guy, basically. And they find themselves, in the last decade, they've kind of floundered to try to keep paying for this because they live in constant fear of a water main break in the winter, because then they're liable for whatever water they use they have to pay for, and they have to actually fix the infrastructure. And they ended up racking up a massive amount of debt that, let's face it, 200 people can't pay for. They just can't. They're not in a position to pay for it. And they've struggled mightily over in recent years with this massive load of responsibility on them. And as a state, this is where we are at. You know, we have to decide, is this something that we think is worth paying for? Is public health worth paying for? Because we are going to have to pay one way or another.
Well, that's what I was going to get to with the fines and the violations that are not enforced. Because, as I said, fines, which is money being taken away for correcting those violations. That's when you talk about between a rock and a hard place, that's exactly where they are.
And the head of the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority brought this up because they faced a multi-million-dollar fine based on their violations, which were very severe. What the DEP ended up doing in that case is they carved off a portion of it to go toward assisting low-income residents with kind of replacing their pipes and assisting them with their bills and so forth. But they still kept a certain amount of that fine that would have to be paid basically as a penalty. The argument there is, in Pittsburgh, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but there was a very highly publicized switchover in the what's called a corrosion control. These are chemicals that are added in the treatment process to make sure that the lead pipes do not disintegrate as water flows through them. And if you're familiar with Flint, that was part of the problem there too. They switched the chemicals that they were using to keep lead from leaching out of the pipes. Pittsburgh, under a private manager, they did something similar. And at the time, they made public statements saying, well, this will save us X amount of dollars. What the DEP did in that case was they said, well, you claim that this would save you X amount of dollars, so this is why we are fining you X amount of dollars. This is something that we have to deal with, because either ratepayers, the people who are customers of these systems, will have to pay for these upgrades and pay to make sure that they have clean water, or taxpayers will have to pay for it in the form of money that gets handed down either by the federal government or the state government to try to improve this whole morass.
We only have about 2 minutes left, Wallace, and we will have a link to your stories on our website, WYTF.org. But the website, if people want to go directly
to... it's very simple. It's water.penlive.com.
Okay. So what can be done? I mean, in 2 minutes or less, if you can explain what consumers, homeowners can do to protect themselves.
Knowledge is power, first of all. Find out what the water quality is like in your community. There's an EPA database called ECHO, which E-C-H-O. Just Google it and go to it. Also, if you go to our project, we show you how to work your way through the state database. Find out what the water quality is like in your neighborhood. The data, it may not always be reliable, but it'll give you a place to jump off from. If you need to, you can test your own water in your home, and that will give you some kind of sense of what's going on with your water. Most importantly, install a filter. You know, that you have filters that will treat a whole house. Also, if you have get a Brita pitcher and make sure you understand how it works. Make sure that you replace the filters when you're supposed to. And also, if you know what the water quality is like and it's bad, replace that filter more often than is recommended, because water filters, they are a filter. They clog. And also, become active. Find out what the problems are in your own neighborhood. Find out what the problems are in your local water system. And you are a customer. Remember, you have a constitutional right to clean water. If you feel that's not being upheld, speak out. Go to a water board meeting if you're in a municipal water system. Reach out to your private water supplier if you don't agree with something that they're doing. Reach out to the DEP. You can file a complaint with the DEP. They're struggling, they're short-staffed, but at least you're getting it on record, and maybe they can do something about it. And finally, you know, and this is true of every problem in government, from top to bottom. Get to know your lawmakers. Do not just send them a form letter. Do not just call their secretary. Get to know them. Go out when they have a public event. Go out and see them. When they when you are troubled by something, send them a handwritten letter. Think about what arguments you want them to hear, and then don't just do it once. Do it many times. Because, let's face it, in Harrisburg, drinking water has not been a top priority. It's not something that we often talk about. It's not even something we often think about. So if you're an active consumer, and if you are an active citizen, it's more likely that we will talk about it.
Wallace McKelvey, Penn-Live State House and investigative reporter. Wallace, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. In this segment of the program, we focus on clean water ways. Turkey Hill Dairy is partnering with farmers that supply milk to the company to keep streams clean. Farms that enter into contracts with Turkey Hill will have to have a conservation plan in place, and the project helps farmers pay to develop those plans. Joining us is John Cox, who is the president of Turkey Hill Dairy. Mr. Cox, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Good to be here.
Also, Jenna Mitchell is with the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay. She's the Pennsylvania State Director. Ms. Mitchell, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call, or you can send us an email at smarttalk@witf.com. Leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And I should point out, when I say that Turkey Hill is partnering with the farmers, there are several partners involved in this project, and the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay is one of them. John Cox, let me start with you. How did the Turkey Hill Clean Water Partnership come about?
Well, we have been involved with the Lancaster County Clean Water Partners over the last couple of years, developing strategies for cleaning up Lancaster's waters. And as we were in the process of renewing our contract for milk supply, it occurred to us that it might be an interesting process to ask our farmers if they have a conservation plan in place, and if they don't, would they be willing to have one in place as a part of our relationship with them? And then in the process of doing that, we started to ask, so how would that get paid for? And so it was really an iterative conversation with the farmers that led to this relationship.
But why did you want to do it? You said an interesting conversation, but why would Turkey Hill want to do this?
Well, to be perfectly honest, it's in our self-interest. We like to look at our relationship to the community in terms of what's good to give back to the community, as well as what adds to the quality of life for our employees. And one of the big issues I think facing Lancaster County, you can look at it as a threat, or you can look at it as an opportunity. If you look at it as an opportunity, one of the big issues is the opportunity to have clean water for the citizens of our county. And so we think it's a quality of life issue.
Quality of life, but, I mean, you're being a good citizen in the Lancaster County community. But is there a benefit to the company's bottom line, being able to say that your products are produced in a sustainable way?
Well, time will tell. You know, it's hard to measure. Consumers want companies to behave responsibly, and they want sustainable, products and things like that. Getting people to pay extra for it's not always easy, and it's not our primary objective.
Jenna Mitchell with the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay. Lancaster County is ground zero for cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay, just because of all the farms, all the agriculture, all the soil runoff, manure, fertilizer, all those things. So talk about why you became part of this partnership.
Yeah, so the Alliance has a program called Businesses for the Bay, where we try to have conversations with businesses about how we can bring them resources to help, help them accomplish goals similar to that of Turkey Hill. And we actually met John at a forum that we were holding in Lancaster County. We've obviously been focusing a lot on Lancaster County for the reasons that you just mentioned. And so as John was, thinking through this with Turkey Hill, we actually went right ahead and applied for a grant to try to bring resources to the farmers that he would be making this ask of. And so it's worked out really well between Turkey Hill and their co-op, Maryland, Virginia, and then my team at the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay and our office in Lancaster County. It's just been a wonderful team that's really, got our eye on the target, and we've been moving forward, and it's been a very quick 6 months. We've only been really moving since January, but it's amazing to see what Turkey Hill's ask has been able to do for the agricultural community already.
Mm-hmm. So, John Cox, I saw a quote from you in the newspaper where you said that you have yet to meet a farmer who wants their soil to run off. That for the most part, that's what they want, a conservation plan. The issue has always been money. So how does it work that this partnership will help farmers come up with a conservation plan, and then probably what's even more expensive is implementing that conservation plan?
Well, there's really two sides of it. And the one side is really the role that the Alliance is most effectively playing, and that's finding the organizations that are willing to fund the writing conservation plans, and then ultimately the implementation. And there are a lot of sources out there that are willing to help farmers. So they're going to help bring that money to the table. We'll be paying a small premium for the milk that we buy moving forward in the future.
So just to clarify, small premium, you're going to pay the farmers who are participating in this. They will get more for their milk, for example.
Yes. It's not a lot, but over the years it will help pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell you, the key, I want to really say the key is what the Alliance is doing, because they're helping to bring the grants and the other partners to the table to help fund some of this work for farmers.
Jenna Mitchell, if you could, Describe a conservation plan that a farmer would come up with.
Yeah, absolutely. So a conservation plan was originally meant to make sure that that farmer was managing his soil so that way that soil would not be lost. So it was actually originally meant to help the farmer himself and didn't really have the focus on our stream. So that conservation plan is looking at what he's doing with his fields, what he's doing with his animals, really how he's managing his whole farm, his or her whole farm, to make sure that it's sustainable and that soil is going to be kept on the field and that we're managing the manure in the appropriate way.
Mm-hmm. So typically, what does it cost? I imagine there are a lot of factors that go into that.
Yeah, but, I would say on average, it's about $1,000 for a conservation plan.
The conservation plan. What about implementing those conservation plans?
Yeah, that's the kicker. That can be, I mean, depending on what they've got already on their farm, it can be upwards of $100,000. I mean, especially a manure storage facility, that's very costly. There's some things that are cheaper, but there's some of our conservation practices that can be very costly to a farmer and they just can't afford right now.
So this is a way to help them pay for it.
Oh, absolutely. That's really, especially in Pennsylvania, that's one of our main goals at the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay is to bring funds to the table. As John has touched on, I would say the significant majority of our farmers want to do the right thing. They want to have any practice that they need on their farm installed and implemented, but they just simply can't afford it. In some of our other projects, when we've, especially working with the Amish, there's this misconception that, you know, plainsect farmers don't want to do anything for the environment. I don't think we've been told no yet since we've been in Lancaster. It's usually just comes down to cost that I can't afford the percent. We usually ask for a cost share. So if we're told no, it's because they can't afford their percentage.
Is it better for the farmers in the long run?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially things like a manure storage facility and a stabilized barnyard. You're not up to your knees in manure. Your animals aren't up to
there.
yeah, absolutely. And the animals' health is better as well. Mm-hmm. So there's fewer vet bills.
So, John Cox, how does this work?
You mean in terms of the implementation of it?
No, I mean as far as working with the farmers. I mean, I know you have some rules in place geographically and that kind of thing. Who's eligible that can work with you?
Well, our relationship is with Maryland, Virginia Farmers Co-op. So they're, and I, a huge shout out to them because they're visionary in terms of wanting to partner with us in this way.
I second that.
But they're, Maryland, Virginia sounds like far away, but it's not. Actually, they've got many farms in Pennsylvania, and we have a supply of about 100, let's just say for sake of discussion, about 100 farms who will be supplying milk to us from Pennsylvania, and those are the farmers that are initial relationship through Maryland, Virginia co-op is with. Over time, if this is successful, I would hope, it's my hope and my expectation that the Alliance in Maryland, Virginia and other co-ops might very well extend this to other farms. But initially, it's focused on those who supply milk to Turkey Hill Dairy. And when we first started having the conversation, you know, Maryland, Virginia said, well, we can probably get people who have conservation plans to supply you with milk. And I said, no, that's not what I want. What I want is, who are the best farms to supply us milk? And then any of them that don't have conservation plans or implemented ones, let's help them get there. And so that's what we're trying to do.
You know, that probably sticks out to a lot of people that it's Maryland, Virginia Dairy Co-op. Why not a Pennsylvania organization?
Actually, the co-op, I think 2/3 of their farms are in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, they have about 1,300 farms, and 800 of those are in Pennsylvania. And Turkey Hill, I mean, I don't want to speak for John, but I know that they've asked that all of the farms that supply them are from Pennsylvania, and the majority of the farmers that we are working with are in Lancaster. So it's really just the title.
And, well, you know, one of the things I also thought about is that when we talk about the Chesapeake Bay, Maryland, Virginia obviously has a big stake in it as well.
Absolutely.
As Pennsylvania. We only have about a minute or so left. I want to thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
So I'm curious, John Cox, do you think that actually you only have about 20 seconds left? I was going to ask if this was the wave of the future, but I think it is that we have a lot of things. I want to thank you very much, Jenna Mitchell, Pennsylvania State Director, Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay, John Cox, President of Turkey Hill Dairy. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we have some pre-Independence Day programming working tomorrow. Talk about the Declaration of Independence and others. That's coming up tomorrow.